Welcome to Geburtsgeschichten Podcast. My regular listeners will know that this show is usually in German, but today we have an English episode. My guest is Alan Heed, who has many talents, but speaking German isn't one of them. So we have this conversation in her native tongue, English. For my German listeners, if the level of English is too complex for you to follow, you can head over to YouTube and you will find a video recording of this conversation with either German or English subtitles to read along while you listen. The links are in the show notes below. Alan Heed has a PhD in somatic psychology and sexology, and she is a pioneering somatic educator and founder of the STREAM School. STREAM stands for Scar Tissue Remediation Education and Management. With decades of experience, Alan has developed groundbreaking techniques for scar remediation, particularly for pelvic floor injuries and dysfunction. And in my conversation with Alan today, I talk about my own experience with endometriosis, an unwanted and unplanned C-section with a very large incision, and my really surprising and spontaneous recovery from pelvic prolapse after my second birth, which was a vaginal birth. It was a home birth. So I'm very excited to bring you today's episode with Alan Heed. Enjoy. Geburtsgeschichten. Ich bin Thea Mayer. In diesem Podcast erzählen Frauen von ihrer Schwangerschaft, der Geburt und dem Wochenbett. Welcome, Alan Heed. I am so excited that you are joining me on this podcast today. Could you please introduce yourself to my listeners?
Sure. My name is Alan Heed, and I am an administrator now of a school called STREAM. It stands for Scar Tissue Remediation, Education, and Management. That's the acronym. STREAM is about working with scars, but not just physical scars in the physical body. We also work with emotional scars and existential scars. In other words, the meaning we make of our injuries or our prolapse. We have to get to the meaning level of what it is and how we interpret it, because the stories we tell ourselves influence our physiology at a very profound level. So we're working on the existential, the emotional, and certainly the physical. And we work with scars from birth and scars from anything that happens in life. People get injured, there are surgeries, there are emotional wounds and physical wounds. They get wrapped up together and then they create problems, especially scar tissue and occasionally extra tension in the pelvic floor. That extra tension can affect everything from the placement of the bladder, the uterus, the rectum, to painful penetration during sex, and especially birth-related scars, because they really went unrecognized in the medical profession for so long. And it was suggested to me that I really address birth-related scar tissue by the man who taught me body work. And I took it on and got very serious about it. And then people started coming to me who had birth-related scars. And we discovered many things. We discovered that there can be extreme scar tissue or a lack of lymphatic drainage in the pelvic floor that can linger for months after a birth, and that it can be resolved in a single session with bringing the whole body, the emotional body, the existential body, the physical body, along together. And using castor oil, I don't think anyone had really done a lot of work with castor oil until about the 2010s when I started to use it. I had a client who was a surgeon, and he was also a pharmacologist. And I asked him, is it safe to use castor oil on the vaginal mucosa? He said, yes, if you're ready for that one in 250,000 people who's allergic, and you have to know where your local ER is in that case. So far, I haven't found that one in 250,000. I've worked with thousands of people now. So you know, it's paying attention to what you're doing and knowing what you're doing. That the truth is sometimes people sensitized to castor oil could be a little bit itchy, a little bit burny. That just means you need to take a break. It doesn't mean you shouldn't use it unless it's extreme itching or burning, if that makes sense. Don't use it every day. Use it every one day, take 2 days off, et cetera. So, you know, we're sort of jumping ahead here.
Yeah, so I was going to say, we're going to talk about the castor oil applications in a little bit. But before we do that, I would love to ask you my one question that I always ask all my guests, because this is the Birth Stories podcast. And I would love to know how you were birthed into this world. What do you know about your own birth?
What I know is that it was a hospital birth. It was in 1957. That's a very long time ago. And in the 50s, women were given scopolamine. It's called the twilight sleep. A lot of them didn't remember. My mother didn't remember giving birth to me. There was no bonding. I was taken away and, you know, marched down to some other room. And she didn't see me again for a while. And when she did see me, she was woozy from the drug. But she still, you know, fell in love and we had something resembling bonding. But the hormones weren't at their peak at that moment, as they can be right after birth. And she regretted that for the rest of her life. That's my birth story. My mother had a lot of, when she started researching and getting interested in bonding and child development, she read a lot. She's a very well-educated woman. She's curious about it. She realized that she missed that with me. And so she spent her life trying to make up for it by being very effusive in her affection. But there's something unique that happens at that moment, right? When the hormones after birth are at their peak, oxytocin, serotonin, dopamine are peaking at that moment. And that's when bonding can happen. And if the moment is missed, it's a unique opportunity in our complete human experience.
I mean, there were so many women at that time that went through that. So it's like a whole generation of kids and mothers who missed out on that.
Well, arguably, it could be said that the 60s were a reaction to that, the me generation, because if I'm not part of us, then I must be me. And so taking care of myself, I have to do everything on my own. Nobody's really here for me. A lot of those birth stories get incorporated at the unconscious level, at the existential level. How do we make meaning of our lives without that birth and bonding connection?
Yeah. I mean, that would be a whole podcast episode of its own. But today I would love to talk to you about scars and scar tissue. I found your work fairly recently and I went into a deep dive. I put your name into Spotify and I listened to every single podcast episode that came up.
Oh my goodness.
I also started reading your PhD thesis on women's pain after giving birth, after birth injuries. And then, well, while I was doing that, I just started experimenting with the things that you suggested. And I had a very profound experience that I didn't expect, which I would like to talk about. But maybe I'll just give you and the listeners a little bit of my, I would say, health background to kind of like understand the full picture. So I'm a mother of two. And before I conceived my first child, I've had endometriosis. And I am very conscious in saying I had endometriosis because I don't think I still have, like, I don't have any symptoms.
I want to hear about that.
Yeah. So I was kind of like the typical endometriosis story in the sense that I was having symptoms for nearly 8 years before I got a diagnosis. But what was unusual in my case was that for the first, I would say, 5 years, I didn't have any menstrual pain, but I had severe pain in my right shoulder all the way down my right arm into my hand. So sometimes my whole arm would go numb.
Oh, this is so interesting.
Yeah. Wow. I thought you would like that. I realized that this pain was cyclical. It would start, like I could tell that my period was coming because my shoulder would start to hurt. And then the pain would last for about 2 weeks. And then I was pain-free for about 2 weeks.
And I told doctors over and over again, and, you know, everyone said, oh, there can't be a connection between shoulder pain and your menstrual cycle. And then over the years, as my life got more stressful, I was living in London, running a yoga studio, cycling everywhere, being a vegan most of the time, vegetarian / vegan diet, and I got really painful periods as well. And then a practitioner who actually worked out of the treatment room from my yoga studio, she was a physiotherapist and a herbalist, and she was the first one to suggest that maybe I have endometriosis. And she said, your symptoms are a bit unusual, but maybe it's endometriosis. And I went home and I Googled endometriosis and shoulder pain. And immediately what came up was endometriosis on the diaphragm. And I sometimes couldn't breathe because of the pain I had in my shoulder. And like at that time, it was like the peak pain. I would take 1,600 milligrams of ibuprofen every day for these like 2 weeks where I was in pain.
Wow.
Just to kind of like function. And
oh my gosh. That tells me such a story already. Wow. Okay.
Yeah. So the first thing I did, I went to a GP in London, and because I'd lived in London for about five years. And I hadn't been to a gynecologist there, so I needed a referral to actually get into to see a gynecologist. And I actually moved out of London 6 months later, and I never saw a gynecologist in that time. And then I only got diagnosed when I moved to Vienna and I saw someone here. But in the meantime, I started my own research and I found a book on diet and endometriosis, and I saw a dietitian who specialized in endometriosis. And in the beginning, it was completely overwhelming because I started cutting out everything, sugar, gluten, coffee, alcohol, all the fun things. But I was still a vegetarian. So I was basically just eating vegetables. And things got worse for a little bit, but then they started to get better. And then I reintroduced fish and I thought, maybe I'll eat a little bit of salmon once a week. And the first time I ate salmon, I was just like, oh my God, my body needs this. And I started eating fish in the beginning every day, and then I started reintroducing meat. And then I moved to Vienna. I was diagnosed, luckily, not via laparoscopy. I had an MR eye scan first.
And that
showed the endometriosis on my liver, actually. It was not on my diaphragm. It was on my
liver. Exactly. That was my first thought. It has to be liver. If it's right shoulder pain, this is liver gallbladder. Absolutely. Fascinating. Yeah. And so we don't even think about endo getting north of the diaphragm. We think the diaphragm is a barrier and endo can't travel. It absolutely can and does. They even found endo in the brain.
Yeah.
There's even 17 cis men who have endometriosis. Can you believe that? How does that happen?
Yeah, it's crazy to think what things can happen in the body.
Exactly.
And then, I mean, for me, I was like, I saw an endometriosis specialist who was really intrigued by my case, and he straight away wanted to operate on me. And I said, hold on, I would like to try to conceive first. And if I can't conceive within 6 months, then I'm considering surgery. And he was really happy with that. He was a very lovely doctor. And I tried to conceive, I think 2 months after that, and I fell pregnant on the first attempt. By that time, I still had painful periods, but it was manageable. I wasn't on painkillers anymore, and it was good. And then I had my first son, who was born via an unplanned C-section. Some would call it an emergency C-section. I had a general, but that wasn't because of the emergency status. It was because the epidural hadn't worked the whole labor. So I didn't see my son for 2.5 hours after he was born, but we had very good bonding. He latched straight away. So all of that was good. And I would say my scar, my incision healed really well. It's really long. My external scar is 19 centimeters long.
Oh, quite long, yes.
Yeah. Mm. The doctor said he has large hands and that's why he needs to make big incisions.
Oof.
Yes.
Gosh.
Yeah, I'm not going to say anything about that doctor. He wasn't my favorite. But it healed well, and I was doing physiotherapy. It was a very lovely physiotherapist. She had 2 C-sections herself, so she was really good and manually working on the C-section scar. Mm. And it took about a year until the scar was numb anymore, and I always had a bit of a pulling sensation on the right side. And that actually, my physio. She also does internal work, but she says she has short fingers. And she actually referred me to a colleague who had longer fingers. And she manipulated a point on the left side inside my pelvic floor. And then that pulling on the right side of my scar resolved. So I went into my second pregnancy 3.5 years later, and I had a vaginal birth. I had a home birth, and everything was fine. But the birth was a bit challenging in the sense that I didn't have a natural urge to push, which I sometimes think maybe that's related to scar tissue. I don't know. But I pushed out a 4-kilo baby without any physiological urge to push. And I had a second degree tear, which was stitched up by the lovely student midwife who attended my birth. And I thought everything was great. But then actually, this recovery was much harder than my first, in the sense that a week after birth, I started having foot pain in my right foot. And I was diagnosed with plantar fasciitis, which everyone says, oh, it can happen postpartum, it goes away after a year. But I could always feel that it wasn't only in my foot. I could feel that it was going all the way up into my lower back, my right hip, and kind of like to my mid back. And I would tell my physiotherapist, and she was a bit like, she actually did a little bit of work on my scar after the second birth, but she was focused more on my pelvic floor, and I had a prolapse, a second degree cystocele, and my diastasis recti wouldn't close. And I was really frustrated because I'm a yoga teacher. I teach postnatal recovery yoga, and I just felt really helpless because I couldn't heal myself. And I would tell everyone that there was a connection that I could feel, and everyone just looked at like their little bit. And then earlier this year in March, I had like really bad back spasms. I couldn't move. It was so painful. I had to call a doctor to give me a painkiller shot. And then I went to a doctor a couple of weeks later again, and they gave me cortisol shots. And it was in my lower back. So my back was better, but I realized, okay, also my foot doesn't hurt. So I also got a cortisol shot for my foot, because at that time I was just, there was so much pain and I had to get on with mothering in life. But it also gave me that it was like, okay, there's some inflammation going on, and I couldn't quite tell where the inflammation was coming from all of a sudden. And also this hip pain, it was like something I've never felt before. It always felt like I needed to stretch my hip, but I didn't know where to stretch it from.
Yes.
And then I went to see an osteopath. I love my physiotherapist, but I just thought I'm going to try someone else. And I told her just a little bit of the story. And she looked at me and she says, lie down on the table. And she went straight into my C-section scar. And I almost jumped off the table. I just didn't know what had hit me.
Yeah.
It felt like the first time after the C-section had happened.
Yeah.
And then I was like, oh my God. Like my first thought was like, oh my God, maybe I ruptured during my home birth and no one noticed. And that was my first thought, that maybe that had created new scar tissue. And I saw her, I think, 3 or 4 times, and all my pain was gone. Like after the first session, my pain was reduced by 80%. So I got more and more curious about scar tissue. That's when I found you, and then started doing castor oil packs, which I'd done previously for the endometriosis, but had kind of like forgotten about, even though I had always put castor oil on my second degree tear, which healed really nicely. And then I was focused on, because the back pain had gone, the foot pain had resolved, but this hip pain was still there. And I was focusing on healing that. And I heard you talk about castor oil tampons for the internal application of castor oil. And I thought, okay, maybe there is some scar tissue that is causing that hip pain. And the day I did it, well, I should mention, I hadn't used tampons or cups or anything internally since my first birth, because it just didn't feel good. And I tried a castor oil tampon, and I just had this feeling like I had to get it out of me immediately. Also, after my second birth, my physiotherapist recommended the thingies you put into your vagina to help with your prolapse.
A pessary.
A pessary, thank you. She recommended the pessary, and I put it in, and I got a headache straight away. Mm-hmm. Like I can feel the connection between like my pelvis and going all the way up into my head and neck. So I never used the pessary. And I always had that feeling like I just need to get it out. And then actually in September, I went to Oxford to see Kimberly Ann Johnson for a day-long workshop. And she just did a very short session on me. It was just a external kind of like just holding my pelvis. And that was amazing. It shifted a lot. There was some renegotiation from both of my births happening, and it was a beautiful space. I was witnessed by 30 women, and that gave me a whole new kind of like awareness of everything, like the whole structure in my body. And during that session, for just a little while, she put her hand on my vulva. And again, I had that feeling of the connection between my vulva and my head, and kind of like that tension, but it wasn't tension. It was just a sensation. And after that, I decided, okay, I'm going to try the castor oil tampon again. And I'm just going to see if I can treat it as a sensation rather than something that feels unpleasant. And I'm busy with two little children and work and everything. So when I did it, I thought, okay, I'll just put that tampon in. And then I had to jump on my bicycle to pick up my son. So I was cycling through Vienna, and I actually listened to one of your podcast episodes while that happened. And it was the most trippy bike rides of my life. Because as I started to cycle, I could feel sensation go all the way up. And it started in my pelvis and then basically the midline of my body. And there was lots of memory coming up from actually an IUD incision that I've had 7 years ago, 8 years, no longer, 10 years ago. That was really painful, and I hated the IUD. I was bleeding for 6 months every day, and then I took it out, and I was really depressed while I had it. And the moment it was out, everything was fine again. And I had completely forgotten about that. But that kind of like came up. But then there were all these sensations in my body, and I think what happened was that my fascia reorganized.
That's right.
And it's really difficult to explain, but it like went all the way up, and it went into my throat. And
it absolutely happens. It absolutely happens. It's amazing.
Yeah. And it went all the way up into the roof of my mouth. And then it kind of like settled. So by that time, I had like gone to pick up my son, come back home. He had fallen asleep on the bicycle. So I carried him upstairs and I lay down on the bed with him. And by that time, the whole sensation had kind of like moved down towards my pelvis. And it had like, it felt like there was a suction cup at the top of my pelvis, pulling everything up. And I just kind of like let it pass. And then because I had this memory of the IUD incision, I had that feeling of, okay, I really need to close my legs for a little bit. So I just crossed my legs and I held my hands over my vulva for a little bit. And then I kind of like, I could relax and let it go. And I got up and I went to the toilet and took out the castor oil tampon. And as I got up from the toilet, I was like, something is different. And I just had a feel and I was like, oh my God, my prolapse is not there anymore. And I couldn't believe it. And then I took out a mirror and I would say it was gone about 90%. Like it's still a little bit visible, but it was just like, I couldn't believe it. I felt, to be honest, in the beginning, I was just like, this can't be.
Oh, but it is.
I know it is. But I just, like it was a really trippy day. And really amazing. And
yes.
So, yeah, I would love to talk to you about all of it, the endometriosis, the...
So many things to say. There are so many Easter eggs in your story to be explored in terms of unpacking, understanding, looking at them, going, oh, here's a relationship that needed to be addressed that was missed by a physiotherapist that the osteopath really saw that was caused by that wide fan and steel incision. That's a transverse incision over your pubic bone with a C-section delivery. It's clear to me that there was psoas impact, possibly even psoas injury during that fan and steel incision. And if not direct psoas injury, there was certainly scar tissue that affected your right psoas. And that right psoas affects back pain and it affects spinal alignment and it affects the entire midline because the psoas controls the amount of space between the bones of the lumbar spine. And if it's tight and if it's not stretching and not moving, that feeling of needing to stretch your right hip is because your psoas wasn't its normal extensible self. As a yoga teacher, you would be very sensitive to that because there's so many deep yoga, deep psoas stretches in the yoga vocabulary. And your body is little bit by little bit, as the scar continues to grow and develop, incrementally less able to find that full psoas extension. So when the osteo went straight into the incision, they went right into the scar, right into the psoas, and probably released both, which would then relieve the pain all the way back to that low back place in between the bones of the lumbar spine. That's how I'm seeing this. The castor oil tampon gave your body permission to unwind a lot of trauma that was based on this memory. And you had a whole somatic recall moment on a bicycle going to get your son. I've never heard of somebody inducing their own moment of somatic recall. This is amazing. But this is also because you have a highly sensitive body. Obviously, you're tracking these sensations and relationships. And interesting to me that the epidural didn't work during your second labor. That's very interesting to me. I'm not exactly sure why, but I have a feeling that there was a need to override the epidural to make sure your pelvis was safe. You didn't want to go numb there, even though the labor pains were probably very intense. Ultimately, there was a feeling of unsafety about, I can't lose track of this because what if it's like that time they put in an IUD and it was so horrible? This is unconscious. This is all somatic memory, which is more primitive than our cognitive memory. But what we remember in the fascia is incredibly distinct and very detailed about bad things that happened in the past. Because I work with fascia all the time and these stories emerge. I don't know why I'm telling you this, is what people will say. And that's when, oh, it's time to really listen up. This is the voice of the fascia speaking. The fascia will speak through the cognitive mind when it feels safe and when there's space and an attentive hand is listening. The hand is all, I always thought the hand was necessary, but here you are having this whole experience based on a castor oil tampon on a bicycle, which is really amazing. I bet it was trippy, but what can happen is the whole midline can re-knit. That it can reorganize completely because there's so much intelligence. Where's the intelligence? In the interstitium. The interstitium is the meridian system. What is the midline? It's conception vessel. The two most important extraordinary channels in Chinese medicine, Ren and Du, the governing vessel in the back, the conception vessel in the front, is our midline organizing information of energetics. That's fluid flow plus electrical conductivity. Something about that tampon communicated with the midline, and the midline's, oh, I'm a little disorganized. Let's re-knit. I want to know what happened to your diastasis. Please tell me about that.
Well, I can say that since that day, all my trousers are a bit too loose.
There you go. Right?
I know. Like my waist, like I didn't measure it, but I noticed that my waist is slimmer since that happened. Right. And I can feel because I've been checking a lot, and I like my diastasis was basically open from the top to the bottom, and it's still a bit open above and below the navel, but between the ribs, it's, I would say it's completely or almost closed.
Yeah. This is a psycho-spiritual event. It's that filters down into the physiology. Somebody has to feel safe for this to happen because you put in your own tampon. But because when Kimberly put her hands on you, something clicked in terms of safety. That's what I'm guessing. Oh, I feel seen, held. My birth story is being acknowledged and witnessed even at a non or pre or, well, just say nonverbal level here. I imagine things were quiet while she was holding the bones of your pelvis. But that bone holding is talking to our essential bony memory, which gets disturbed, distorted, and otherwise out of kilter as a result of going through labor, especially in a medicalized environment. And, you know, you still have memories of there's this uncomfortable IUD placement. There's this C-section with that really impinged or affected my right psoas. There is now a birth and they, you know, I'm supposed to get an epidural, but I'm not getting that epidural. That's a lot of information that the body's trying to process. But in that feeling, you know, this podcast is about birth stories. there are many ways to witness a birth story. One is verbally, and that's what we're doing here. Another is manually, just by holding bones. And this is the first thing that stream students learn is bone holding. How to hold the bones in a kind of almost osteopathic way, because I have training as a cranial sacral teacher and taught cranial sacral for many years. I understand how to read, feel, and hold what's moving and what's not moving in the bones as somatic story. You don't have to say anything. You just have to witness. You have to witness with awareness and follow the bony movement. And the connective tissue element of the bones connects all the way up into the dura, connects into the brain, and something fundamental changes, like a midline starts to reknit. And in fact, happened to Kimberly herself. I was working on her at one point, and her diastasis reknit instantly in one session. That was the weirdest thing I ever saw in my life. I mean, it was a two-finger diastasis, three-finger diastasis, and there was fecal incontinence. There's a lot of things going on there. And we did some intraanal work, and I did up behind the pubic bone on the back of the linea alba. That's the midline attachment at the pubic symphysis, just holding it. And it started going roo, 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 on its own. I'm like, what the heck is this? I'd never felt that before. And then just boop, 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 she got up. She's like, wait, my diastasis, what? So our bodies have
all these stories on your podcast, including Kimberly's. And I just thought, okay, that sounds really nice, but I didn't expect that it could happen to me on my bicycle.
You did it for yourself on a bicycle. That's astonishing. But I want to say that without the permission of that bone holding experience, that might not have happened.
I think so too. And actually, there's one element that I forgot to mention earlier, which also I think played into this. And that's, I mean, we've been talking without naming the four domains of health that you talk about.
Yes.
So there was the emotional aspect, and then there was the actually like the biomechanics of the bone holding, but there was also a biochemical aspect. So I was saying earlier, I was wondering why all of a sudden my C-section scar was so inflamed again, basically, after my second birth. And then when I listened to all of your stories, I realized what happened was, so when I was aware that I had endometriosis, I changed my diet and I cut out gluten. And I actually, I think it was still in my first pregnancy. I did like a test and it came back that I'm not gluten intolerant. It said, it's fine, you can eat gluten. But I didn't eat gluten until I was pregnant again with my second, because I was suffering nausea and vomiting, and my husband had just started doing his own sourdough bread. And I just thought, okay, I'll just try a little bit of his sourdough bread. And it was fine. I could eat it, but I didn't realize that I think I am gluten intolerant, even though that test said I wasn't. So I started eating gluten again more and more. And actually, after I came back from Oxford, where I had that bone holding session with Kimberly, a few days later, I had a mouth ulcer for the first time in my life. And I couldn't eat anything solid for a whole week. So what I did is I made meat stock and just mixed that with vegetables. So it wasn't in any way like a full GAPS protocol or anything, but I just ate soups based on meat stock and eggs, like scrambled eggs. These were the two things I could eat for a whole week. And that, like, I could feel it was like a real big cleanse. And I also stopped eating gluten in that week, and I haven't eaten gluten since. So I think there were lots of things that were coming together.
Yes, many factors. So we have to talk about the gut flora here. The gut flora are going to influence our overall tendency to inflame, which has everything to do with every pain we have in our body. If the gut flora are skewed in a particular direction, we have to talk about a history of endometriosis here. That means something in terms of gut flora. All the NSAIDs that you took, the non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, NSAID, you know, people take them for pain. And you're telling me about a history of 1,600 milligram doses of NSAIDs during certain periods of your life, but daily, that will decimate your gut flora. So there's a history, and maybe even we didn't talk about early childhood, if there were ear infections or strep or throat infections or colds, and if you were dosed regularly with antibiotics. That's common for so many people these days. That's just something to pay attention to. Anything, the endometriosis is related to gut flora. And people don't know this, but it is. When you start to do
endometriosis started after I had Lyme disease and was on antibiotics for a whole month.
There we go.
My symptoms started. So I'm quite sure that actually that triggered the endometriosis.
So here we are in the realm of biochemistry, is that the antibiotics decimate the gut flora. The gut flora has a hard time recovering its balance. And so opportunistic flora, pathogenic species start to overproliferate in the gut. That means the Peyer's patches. This is the immune, we could call it immune command central for the entire body, is this section of GALT, gut-assisted lymphoid tissue in the small intestine. And the GALT is in communication with all of the lymph system in the body. If lymph can't drain, we're going to be in pain. That's a little rhyme. But when lymph can't drain, you're going to be in pain. So the lymph is putting pressure on places, including, and then there's, you know, we didn't talk about constipation. We don't have to go into detail here, but the comorbidity of constipation, IBS, and endometriosis is very real. There's a lot of literature that supports that. So we have to look at those elements and see. But when people start reversing, they start eating GAPS, they start getting right with their gut flora, they start doing coffee enemas, which will cleanse their liver. Constipation and endometriosis set the liver up for fibrosis. And the fibrotic liver contributes to the endometriosis. It's a, you know, the opposite of a virtuous cycle. It's a non-virtuous cycle of liver stagnation, thickened blood, inflammatory titers, and then a tight psoas. Here's this tight psoas. You know, maybe that psoas, maybe I have a theory that between constipation and a tight psoas, that contributes through pressure on the uterus. You've got the, I'm not saying this is you, but I am saying it is other people I have worked with. They have impacted colons in the back, pushing on the posterior cervix. They've got a short, tight psoas, which is irritated because the colon sits underneath the psoas. When the colon is impacted, there's leaky toxins coming up, inflaming the psoas, causing it to shorten, squeezing the uterus, so retrograde menstruation is more likely to happen. Whoa, who puts that together? I came to that the other day when I was meditating and thinking, and why does endometriosis, what does it have to do with a tight psoas? What does it have to do with constipation? I'm like, oh, it's biomechanical pressure on the uterus itself. And then these endometriomas start to proliferate and they seed themselves once they're in the peritoneum. Every time you bleed, you're bleeding in the endometriomas, which seeds, you know, the bleeding, and then the blood travels and it starts another endometrioma and it climbs up the tree till it's even north of the diaphragm and into the liver, into the lungs, even in the brain. People have found endometriomas in brain tissue. Whoa.
What you just said about the tight psoas and constipation. And I'm like, yes, that's me. I mean, I think the definition of constipation is that you can't go for several days. I exactly. have regular bowel movements, but my stool is always really hard.
Yes.
And that got worse in pregnancy.
Well, it will, because, you know, we can't eat as much during pregnancy. Frequently, people are having bladder sensitivity because there's a baby sitting on their bladder, right? So they're not drinking as much. So dehydration happens and the stool gets harder and harder. Plus, there are hormonal contributions, which are the hormone that keeps you from going into labor also stops peristalsis. So there's a hormonal contribution to constipation that has to be overridden through eating many small meals that have a certain amount of fiber and walking and moving your body to kind of goose the peristalsis along, which a lot of people aren't able to do or don't know that they must do. Plus the whole hydration, because blood volume, doubles during pregnancy. So we need to get the fluid, you know, that's taken to make all this more blood, because it's you and the fetus center. There's all of this need, right? We are running deficient in hydration and in peristalsis during pregnancy, which will certainly contribute to any kind of a pattern around endometriosis. But the preset was always there. You know, there's a tension in the psoas, which to me maps back on how trusting we can be. And if you had a bad experience with an IUD placement, that could, you know, kind of put the body unconscious, the somatic unconscious, on guard around feeling safe in your uterus. And that could have, you know, the uterus and the psoas, again, they're right there. They're right next to each other. Psoas on top, uterus, or at least broad ligament underneath, and the psoas and the broad ligament can get endometriomas on them, which cause them to all adhere together. I mean, there's so many ways to parse this, to go in deep and look at the biomechanics, the biochemistry, the emotions, and then scars. And definitely you had all four elements going on, you know?
Yeah, I mean, there's so much more. Just one thing that I didn't mention in my first burst. My first burst actually started with castor oil. I was encouraged to drink castor oil by the midwife, and I didn't tolerate it well. And I was just actually now listening to you, and you mentioned it in the beginning, that the doctor you spoke to said you should always test for castor oil sensitivity. And I just thought, has any midwife ever done that before they offer castor oil orally?
I doubt it sincerely.
Yeah. And so, yeah, my labor started with me emptying my bowels, like, massively. And then all of a sudden, I had sharp pain in my vagina and my anus. And that pain didn't go away for the 20 hours that I was in labor.
Oh, dear.
And then on top of that, when I arrived at the hospital, the midwife, who was a private midwife that I had hired to be there and paid a lot of money to, she asked if she could do a cervical check, and I agreed. And I think she tried to do a stretch and sweep without consent. And it was the most painful thing in my life. I tried, like, I screamed at her to stop, and I tried to jump off the bed with my big pregnant belly.
Oh my gosh.
And she didn't stop. So I think that was kind of like added on top of the already feeling like I don't want anyone at my cervix from the IUD insertion. And what you just said, the thing about my epidural not working, because there was a sense in me of like, shit, I can't be numb. Like, I need to feel, like, I need to protect
absolute
myself.
Vigilance.
Yeah.
For good reason. Because what if somebody tried to do a membrane sweep again without your consent? I mean, trauma after trauma after trauma. And there's this whole sense of, let's call it unconscious unsafety, which is part of the smooth muscle memory of what's happening. And I just have to say, something else occurred to me in your description of what was happening in your second birth. I wonder if the cervix itself might have been slightly fixated at the back of the vagina as a result of the growth downward of scar from the C-section incision in the uterine wall. This is so common. It comes down, so you have your Van and Steel incision, you know, your transverse incision above the pubic bone. Scar tissue from that incision grows down the wall of the uterus. So here's the uterus. Let's say this is the uterus. Let's say this is the cervix, and here's the vagina. Here's the incision. It grows down this way and fixates the uterus in the vaginal wall. It's supposed to be mobile. What's called these round ligaments of the uterus. They're reaching down over the pubic bone, and the whole cervix should move like this within the uterus, up and down. But after a C-section, that scar tissue grows down, and now this is fixed. It can't move. So the cervix itself is going to have problems with dilation, potentially. You know, this is why BVACs are tricky, because there's already a scar that could be affecting uterine movement at the cervical vaginal junction. And you know how long that takes to fix? About 3 seconds. A little castor oil and a knowledgeable finger ring around the cervix one or two times, and boom, now it's mobile. And then things start to work better, because these connective tissue, smooth muscle entities, which are the vagina, the uterus, the cervix, are able to communicate to each other without restriction. Scars restrict that knowledgeable, internal, intrinsic understanding of what right relationship and communication is between these elements. And if there's a scar...
Can we talk about the scar tissue a bit more? Maybe just for those listeners who are completely new to that, could you just give a definition of scar tissue?
Thank you so much. So a definition of scar tissue is thickened fascia. It's that simple. Extra fascia that keeps proliferating past wound closure. So there's a difference between a wound closure, which is a normal physiologic process. Let's talk about a C-section. You know, there's an incision, and then the two sides of the wound approximate, and then they seal together. And then that should be the end of the story. But sometimes the scar keeps going past the wound closure. The body keeps making scar and making scar and making scar. And that scar starts to travel along the connective tissue matrix, looking for a bone to connect to or to anchor to. I call that a pathological scar. Pathological scar tissue is the basis for so much pain in so many people. Scars that keep producing past their expiration date. Why do scars continue to produce? One word, inflammation. So if somebody, this is a perfect example. Thank you for providing. Let's say somebody has a very mild gluten sensitivity. That's enough inflammation. The gluten's going to bother the Peyer's patches in the small intestine, which is going to talk to all of the lymph throughout the body. It's going to talk to a lot of the connective tissue. The lymph isn't draining. The connective tissue is getting stiffer and more infiltrated by extra thickened collagen. And then the scar tissue itself starts to create, this is brand new research out July this year, fibrinogen and fibrin, the basic elements that create the substrate of scar tissue are in themselves pro-inflammatory compounds. The scar is pro-inflammatory. Once a scar is pro-inflammatory, it will continue to proliferate until the Peyer's patches calm down, which is why GAPS is so important. It calms the initial command and control center. If command and control is on fire, everything's on fire with inflammation. When the gut starts to calm down, everything else starts to calm down, and then those scars can start to repair. And something like castor oil, whose action is to increase lymphatic flow, that's how it works. It's increasing lymphatic flow instead of all the lymph being in freeze because of an emotional reaction to something that happened. It's going to freeze all the smooth muscle cells in the connective tissue to prevent lymph from moving. We need to have fluid flow moving, not just in the lymph, but the interstitium, but they talk to each other. It's very complex.
If the scar keeps growing, if it's an active scar, what can happen? What are the symptoms, especially talking about C-section scars, but also either from an episiotomy or a tear? Like what happens? Because you could just say, okay, the scar grows and it gets bigger. But what are the symptoms that?
It chokes the blood, it chokes the lymph, and it chokes the nerve. You cannot feel, oh, look. So when the lymph is choked, you can't take out the cellular trash. When the blood is choked, you can't bring in the cellular groceries. When the nerve is choked, you can't turn the lights on of self-recognition within the tissue. We have a sense of self, not self, in every cell in the body. Those are receptors that are saying, this is me, this is friendly, I recognize this compound. If you put in somebody else's organ, for instance, those self receptors aren't there. That's part of our immune system. And they shut it down. They shut down our self reception with the immunity when you get a transplant. That's part of it. So all these things are impacted, affected by scars. Our sense of self, this is why scars are existential. Our self receptors on our cells can be shut down by scar, which means we're not able to identify the good from the bad, the healthy from the unhealthy, and unhealthy things begin to proliferate as a result of scars, including brand new research out last month, cancer cells. That scar tissue itself becomes what's called a pre-metastatic niche where cancer cells get trapped like, you know, fluff on a bird's nest. They just accumulate within these scars, especially in the interstitium. And that is pro-metastatic. Whoa.
That is really a mouthful because I just think of like all the women that walk around with scars in their pelvises. And I mean, these days, I hardly know a mother who doesn't have a birth injury.
Well, this is so good that you know that. And it's so good that this podcast is out there and available for people to start to think, oh, right, that C-section, or oh, that episiotomy, or oh, that tear. Have I really dealt with a scar? Have I really restored adequate lymphatic drainage, adequate blood delivery, and adequate nerve delivery? How many people walk around numb? I mean, this was the subject of my dissertation, how scars shut down sexual function in people postpartum, because they're choking off the nerve and the nerve is numb, or else the nerve is distorted and they get pain. Numb or pain is the outcome of a lot of sex after childbirth. And it's because of scar tissue affecting nerves. So yes, it's a really big deal.
Yeah. And I'm also thinking, I mean, in my postnatal recovery classes, I always ask the women how they are. And most of them say like, oh, I'm fine, but my back is hurting a little bit.
Yeah.
And I'm always thinking, well, you've had a C-section, or you told me you've had like a second or third degree tear. And I always ask them, have you checked the scar? Or like, have you had someone look at it? And then they usually say, oh, yeah, like I've seen my physio, and there's this German word basically for scar remediation. And they say like, oh, I've done it once or twice, and my physio said it's fine.
And I'm yeah, like, but the physio is only looking at, it's only looking at the site. It's not looking, scars proliferate. They stretch, they spread anywhere in the body, just like the endo. You had endo on your liver. Oh my gosh. How did it get there? It got there through the movement of blood, the movement of lymph, and fluid movement within the body. Scars are moving through these pro-inflammatory cytokines, are moving through the blood, which get into the ECM all over the body and start scars everywhere. They start an inflammatory process, which will produce scar tissue under your shoulder blade, in your neck, in your jaw, in your midline, in your low back, wherever the pain is. It's related to an inflammatory complex, which is producing scars, which is skewing our senses and creating pain signaling. I mean, this, we don't understand scar tissue, and a physio will may think, well, if I can see it, that's the scar. No, the scar is everywhere.
I think that's a big takeaway. That was the big takeaway from what I've learned from your work, that my C-section scar is not that incision that's visible on my lower abdomen, but that it gets much deeper and wider than I previously thought. Can we talk about castor oil application externally a little bit? Why is castor oil so great?
Castor oil improves lymphatic flow. It's been shown to stimulate lymphocytes. Lymphocytes exist in the lymphatic fluid. They're also within the extracellular matrix. Any place, the space between the cells contains some lymphocytes. Immunity is body-wide. It stimulates an immune response. The evidence for this is incredibly weak. There's one paper that talks about it, and the evidence in that paper is not particularly strong. However, this guy did say that lymphocytes are activated by the application of castor oil. It's not uptaken by blood. It's uptaken by lymph. So once the lymph is flowing, we've broken the habit of this tissue cannot drain. When the tissue can drain, that makes more space for blood delivery. It makes more space for nerve flow. And the tissue itself will start to restore itself. But until that pressure of the extra fluid can move, and this is the main action of castor oil, is to move lymph. That's why it works. So we have to break the chain of lymph not moving, nerve not moving, blood not moving. The easiest way to do that is apply castor oil topically so the lymph can start to drain, and now the body can renegotiate that triad of necessity for cellular health.
Thank you for clarifying that. To wrap up, you've mentioned the interstitium a few times, and because I know there will be lots of German listeners to this podcast, there is a great podcast episode from the Radiolab podcast.
Oh, yes, I'm aware. I've heard it. I listen to it frequently.
Yes. I've just listened to it again recently as well. And I've just, in preparation for this conversation today, I researched, and there's actually one German episode on the interstitium, which is unfortunately a bit disappointing. They start off similar to the Radiolab episode. And then in the end, they're basically saying, meh, we don't really know. Is it a big deal? Meh.
Well, they haven't done their homework. And there's new research. This new research about pre-metastatic niches is they occur in the interstitium. The interstitium is big frickin' news now because of its implications for cancer spread throughout the body. It is not the lymph that spreads the cancer. We've been told, oh, we have to take the lymph nodes because the cancer could spread into the lymph and that's going to take it everywhere. Maybe. That's not the whole story. The interstitium is where now we have proof absolute of the existence of pre-metastatic niches, which are basically fibrin nests. That's a scar by anyone's definition that become entrapment places for the accumulation of rogue cancer cells. So now the interstitium, and they were pointing at this in the radio lab podcast, but now the science is here. Of course, the people who did the science are Chinese. They understand the interstitium because guess what? They identified it thousands of years ago as the meridian system. They map onto each other.
Could you just explain in your words what the interstitium actually is?
The interstitium, they're waterways. They're waterways in the body shown to contain four times more fluid than we have blood. And the reason they've never been discovered before is because we're looking at preserved bodies and you can't see the fluid in a preserved body. You're looking at dried out tissue that's been dehydrated by formaldehyde. If you look at an unfixed body, you still can't see the interstitium because the fluid isn't flowing through it because the body's no longer alive. So the interstitium has remained invisible to science understanding, but it's been visible to people who are energetically sensitive for thousands of years as the meridian system. I was trained as a shiatsu therapist, and I was trained to feel qi move through the interstitium from the get-go. I was, more importantly, trained to feel my own interstitium move as qi, which means heat that goes through the meridian when the meridian is compressed. You stop the flow of the interstitium, you start the flow of the interstitium, and boom, you get this heat that moves down. If you're balanced in your biochemistry, you're balanced in your emotions, you're balanced in your scar tissue, and you're balanced in your biomechanics. When those four elements are in balance, we can feel our own interstitium move. This is the same as the way people get yoga stoned or feel prana, etc. These esoteric energetic sensations are our ability to feel our own interstitium.
Yeah, I was mind blown when I first learned about the interstitium.
It's so beautiful.
Yeah, and then that got me thinking about my scar again, because I always knew that I was basically cut in half with my C-section in a way, but you called the interstitium the waterway, which I thought was quite a nice way to think about it, and then thinking that all of a sudden I have a block, like the water can't flow there because of the scar. That really visualized it for me. And I can feel my energy flowing. I can feel my interstitium. And I was like, that makes totally sense.
Exactly. And when the two main channels, the most important channels that go crowned perineum, Ren and Du, conception vessel and governing vessel, when they're interrupted by an episiotomy, by a C-section, it has an effect on everything, including brain function. The man who told me to investigate scar tissue as my life's work said, you know why? Because he taught at my shiatsu school. He's my teacher. He said, because those birth incisions destroy brain function because they're interfering with the energetic delivery of information from crown to perineum. I mean, he'd go so far as to say that brain cancer was, he was telling me this in 2002, way, way ahead of the research that's now proving it in 2025. It's beautiful.
It is. And I think this is a nice way to end, even though I could talk to you for hours on end. And I hope that one day I can take your stream training and come and see you in Ashland. Right now, my kids are too young, but that's definitely something I am putting in my planning for the next few years. So thank you so much, Ellen. Where can people find you?
Oh, they can find me at the website scartissueremediation.com. That's the easy way. They can find me on Instagram. I'm at Ellen Heed. They can find me on Facebook. I have a Facebook, a professional page for Stream on Facebook, but it's under Ellen Heed, Somatic Educator. So those are the three places people can find me now. There's a Substack coming. There's probably some TikTok videos coming as I get more facile with digital creation, because this is the way to get the word out. It has to happen at a grassroots level, because as you've said, a lot of scientists don't see the bigger implications here. When you can see the bigger implications, it's very, very exciting where we are in history at this moment.
Yes. And I'll put all your links in the show notes. Thank you so much, Ellen.
Oh, what a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to today's episode with Ellen Heed. If you enjoyed the show, please leave me some stars in your podcast app, or even a review, or leave a comment on Spotify right underneath this episode what you've liked and what you've learned from this conversation. Thank you very much. Until next time.